Tomorrow, July 26th, is the Cuban national holiday. The day doesn't commemorate Cuban independence from Spain, nor is it the date in 1959 when the revolution triumphed and the dictator Batista was overthrown. Rather, it refers to the date in 1953 when the movement that overthrew Batista was launched, the Movimiento de 26 de Julio, the July 26th movement, with Fidel Castro and Che Guevara among its principals. This month, July, also marks the one-year anniversary of significant protests that took place against the revolutionary government that resulted from that successful overthrow. It's an appropriate time to assess the Cuban Revolution. Let's start with some ground rules and basic recognitions. First, here's a quote from an excellent recent essay by Michael Leibowitz in Monthly Review Online. I'll draw on Leibowitz's insights throughout this discussion.
No country has faced greater obstacles in trying to build a post-capitalist society than Cuba. Criminal blockades, sanctions, invasions, imperialist terrorism, externally supported internal subversion, the loss of lifelines, natural disasters such as hurricanes and drought, and still, Cuba persists, as does some of the marvelous solidarity that marked its early years. But, like every society in the interregnum between capitalism and community, Cuba has been, and continues to be, characterized by what Fidel called the struggle to the death between the future and the past.
Recognizing what Cuba's been up against, nevertheless, its former ambassador to Venezuela has said, most citizens understand that the long-standing blockade, Donald Trump's draconian measures that exacerbated it, and the pandemic are essential causes of the serious problems we suffer. But many of us also agree that they are not the only ones. The opinion prevails among the people that we must focus on changing and improving everything that is within the country's reach, and not turning such realities of foreign origin into pretexts to justify deficiencies and endogenous errors. By endogenous errors, of course, he means errors made by the revolutionary leadership itself. Here in the U.S., our responsibility vis-a-vis Cuba is to oppose the blockade, the U.S.-generated invasions, the distorted and propagandistic media coverage, etc. But if we think of ourselves as part of an international movement, and we're not going to get anywhere unless we do, it's also important to be aware of the choices made by movements and countries attempting fundamental social transformation, the dilemmas they face, and the mistakes they make. So who are we with our fragmented and unconvincing movement in this country to comment on anyone else's mistakes? If we're to learn from their efforts, as we attempt to do here on the Old Mole and Another World Is Possible, if we're to take inspiration from their struggles and their choices, we have to attempt to evaluate them. Not attempting that would be falling into the same trap parts of the U.S. left have fallen into repeatedly over the past century, treating some movement or country as the fount of all revolutionary wisdom, whether it was the Soviet Union, China, Albania, for God's sake, or Cuba. There are at least two legitimate bases for being thoughtfully critical, while, of course, staying supportive. The first of those is to acknowledge the self-criticisms from within the Cuban revolutionary leadership itself. The second is to draw on what we know about how change happens. As we look at the difficult choices facing Cuba now, and as we think back to the protests of a year ago, here are some typically thoughtful reflections by Fidel Castro toward his last years in leadership.
Here is a conclusion I've come to after many years. Among all the errors we may have committed, the greatest of them all was that we believed that someone really knew something about socialism, or that someone actually knew how to build socialism. It seemed to be a sure fact, as well known as the electrical system conceived by those who thought they were experts in electrical systems. Whenever they said, "That's the formula," we thought they knew, just as if someone is a physician. You are not going to debate anemia or intestinal problems or any other condition with a physician. Nobody argues with the physician. You can think that he is a good doctor or a bad one. You can follow his advice or not, but you won't argue with him.
That was Fidel Castro acknowledging in Cuba the same kind of mistake the U.S. left has made repeatedly, being uncritical about decisions, policies, and perspectives of some other, seemingly more successful movement. In his case, he was talking about following the path of the former Soviet Union and how it distorted the development of Cuban socialism. As we'll see, Cuba faces difficult choices now and risks following another distorting example of supposed socialist expertise. Part of the tragedy is that Cuban leadership was aware of another path, admittedly one without precedent on a national scale, and rejected Che Guevara's cautions about the Soviet model. For more on what Che recommended as an alternative, look back into the Old Mole archives for February 28th of 2021 and the program on Che I did with Old Mole Luisa Martinez. Che was talking about Cuba, to be sure, but also about the kind of genuinely democratic change we want to see everywhere. Che's neglected ideas on social change bring us to that second legitimate basis for supportive criticism, what we know from centuries of experience about how change happens, how people gain a new and enhanced sense of their own capabilities to understand the world and to join with others to transform it. If you're a regular listener to these episodes of Another World is Possible, you know that's a theme we explore regularly from many sides. In his essay I mentioned earlier, Leibowitz quotes Marta Harnacker, outstanding Latin American revolutionary journalist, raising criteria for how to evaluate revolutionary governments. Here's what she said.
Do the governments mobilize workers and the people in general to carry out certain measures? And are they contributing to an increase in the people's ability and power? Do they understand the need for an organized, politicized people able to exercise the necessary pressure that can weaken the state apparatus and power they inherited, and thus drive forward the proposed transformation process? Do they understand that our people must be protagonists and not supporting actors? Do they listen to the people and let them speak? Do they understand that they can rely on the people to fight the errors and deviations that come up along the way? Do they give the people resources and call on them to exercise social control over the process? To sum up, is the government contributing to the creation of a popular subject who is increasingly the protagonist, one who is assuming governmental responsibilities?
How does Cuba stand up to those criteria? And more importantly than any evaluation by us, how does a revolution transmit its revolutionary spirit to subsequent generations? If people aren't increasingly mobilized as the decision makers, if they're left as supporting actors, if the vision of socialism is for the state to do things on their behalf, instead of increasingly equipping them to take over the functions of the state, that participatory elan, that revolutionary spirit, diminishes over time. Which brings us to last year's protests. Again, our starting point for understanding them has to be the illegal U.S. blockade. Without it, Cubans wouldn't face the electricity blackouts, the inability to get medicines from abroad, the shortages of food, the long lines to buy scarce necessities. But the blockade and provocation from abroad are insufficient explanations for the protests. How the revolutionary leadership has chosen to respond to those shortages, blackouts, etc., has exacerbated the difficult conditions for part of the population. Specifically, turning to market mechanisms has not only deepened the inequalities in Cuban society, it has undercut the development of socialist consciousness and revolutionary commitment. Again, that leadership faces difficult decisions, and we're not in a position to say what they should or shouldn't do, but what we can do is identify and even predict the consequences of their decisions. Cuba has pioneered innovative programs to address its social and economic problems. For instance, the recent schools to train thousands of new social workers. We must recognize, though, that those idealistic young social workers are a response to ameliorate the growing inequalities, the lessening social security net, the unemployment, growing poverty, the neglected elders that result from introducing market mechanisms. Turning to capitalist market mechanisms to stabilize its currency, to husband its resources, has meant laying people off. It's meant greater concessions to foreign investment and foreign ownership of Cuban enterprises. It's meant closing communal and workplace eating places, closing entire state-owned enterprises if they can't make a profit in capitalist terms. The results have been predictable in ways we're familiar with in our own capitalist society. Rising prices, corruption, gangsterism, greater social stratification. And in Cuba, as in the U.S., that social stratification takes a racial form. As one Cuban commentator has written, because blacks and mulattoes are overrepresented in that poverty line, they are overrepresented in the worst indicators, the lowest income, poverty, homelessness, the worst jobs, etc. Therefore, there are objective tendencies for the issue of raciality to become a socialist problem for us and a base for the enemy on which he is acting with great energy. End quote. To assess the Cuban Revolution now, in 2022, one day short of its national holiday, is to offer a tale of caution. Michael Leibowitz, in the essay I've cited, reports that Cuban economists are enamored of Chinese and Vietnamese approaches of what they call market socialism. As we look at the possibilities for a better way of organizing our societies, as we advocate that another world is possible, I will suggest that market socialism is an oxymoron, that market-oriented reforms undercut the possibilities for socialism and the ability to maintain revolutionary involvement and revolutionary momentum on the part of the population. Cuba has been an extraordinary place, an experiment for all of humanity. Let's hope it avoids the long slide back to capitalism, under whatever name, and continues to be a revolutionary inspiration. This is Norm Diamond with one more exploration of another world that is possible. Reinforcing that conviction, the other voice you heard was Patricia Kohlberg, reading from Michael Leibowitz, Fidel Castro, and Marta Harnacker.